Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I am Bernard Burke. I am here appearing today for Appellants California Rural Legal Assistance and the attorney interveners. With me today is Martin Glick from Arnold & Porter and Lisa Wonchenko from Morrison & Forster. The overarching question I think that is before the court today on this appeal is to what limited extent Congress intended by statute to authorize federal regulators to intrude into the protections that are accorded the attorney-client relationship under state law. We pointed out in our briefing that in the United States, the regulation of the legal profession has always been the province of state law. And when Congress in 1974 came to legislate a program that provided for the funding of legal services to the poor, what Congress expressly recognized was that it would be staffed by lawyers who were regulated by state law, and that their obligation under state law needed to be accommodated. Now, in broad overview, there are two statutes that we need to reconcile to decide the case, or that you need to reconcile to decide the case. One is the Professional Responsibility Clause of the Legal Services Corporation Act, which embraced and preserved the state's regulations of the legal profession.
Well, wait, let's focus on that, okay? Because it seems to me that that's the critical issue here, right? So you think 2996 EB3 yes. protects state privileges, correct?
Right? I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last
one. I'm sorry, your position is that 2996 EB3 itself protects privileges recognized by the state that go beyond those protected, recognized in the ABA standards, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, although it also protects the generalized standards under the ABA.
But I didn't see in your brief an answer to the government's argument about its interpretation of 2996 EB3. It says the way to interpret this is that the first part of the first sentence, which protects, which prohibits them from interfering with any attorney in carrying out their professional responsibilities to his client, as established in the ABA standards, right?
That is what the government says.
Yeah, and that the second part of the sentence, the abrogate part of it, simply preserves state enforcement authority over its lawyers, but it doesn't itself protect privileges beyond the ABA. And then they point out that the second sentence, the corporation shall ensure that activities carried out in this chapter are carried out in a manner consistent with attorneys' professional responsibilities, which is defined in the previous sentence as those protected by the ABA. And I didn't see an answer in your brief to that argument.
I'm glad you asked, and let me take a moment, if I could, to answer the question. Let me focus first on the first sentence of the statute.
Right.
The first sentence of the statute has two clauses,
right.
Which, Judge Tatel, you very clearly delineated. They have two different verbs. The first clause says that the corporation, which includes the inspector general, may not interfere with professional responsibilities as delineated by some ABA standards. The second clause says that the corporation may not abrogate the authority of a state to enforce.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why the difference between the verbs? I will suggest to you that the difference between the verbs is with respect to interfere. When you're talking about ABA standards, the ABA standards are model standards that are not themselves binding on anyone. They are best practices promulgated by the ABA. They're precatory. States have adopted them in various forms.
That just shows why this is a weird statute. It doesn't show that the state, that we can sub that out and put states in.
I will concede to Your Honor that it is a weird statute, but let me try and explain how it fits together.
Okay.
The reason interfere is used is you can't abrogate anybody's authority to enforce it. It's not enforceable against anyone. The second half of the sentence.
Wait. Repeat
that.
Would you say that again?
Yeah. Sure.
The ABA standards can be interfered with by the government, but they can't, you can't abrogate anyone's authority to enforce them because they're not enforceable against anyone. They're merely precatory standards.
Wait a minute. The state agency, the state bar can enforce those standards against any lawyer practicing in California.
And there's
not correct, Your Honor.
That's not correct.
The State Bar of California has adopted rules of professional conduct, which are in some respects substantively similar to the ABA model rules, but they would never be able to discipline.
Well, what about a court, a California court?
Well, California courts have inherent power to set their own standards for practice before them, which is also true of the federal courts.
Oh, wait,
but there's different language. There's different language in that part of the clause that abrogate as to attorneys and programs assisted under this subchapter the authority of a state or other jurisdiction to enforce, doesn't say to enforce professional responsibility standards, it says to enforce the standards of professional responsibility generally applicable to attorneys in such jurisdiction. So that's different language than the ABA language, which is in the other part of the
That's
clause.
Exactly right, Judge Kavanaugh, and that difference is extremely
I think that hurts you.
I disagree with you. Let me tell
okay.
you why. The difference between every state has adopted rules of professional conduct.
Right.
No state, with the possible exception of Delaware, has literally adopted the ABA model
right.
rules. The state has the authority to discipline lawyers according to the rules it has actually adopted. If a state attempted
still with you.
If a state attempted to discipline a lawyer, discipline a lawyer on the basis of an ABA standard the state had not adopted, it would not be proper to do so. It would be a due process violation.
Right. I think we agree on all that, but I'm keep going.
I'm sorry.
Your whole argument, we all understand. Your whole argument is that the California rules are broader than those in the ABA, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Generally speaking, yes.
So then there are standards that the state of California can enforce that go beyond the ABA standards, and that's the issue before us, right?
That's correct.
The issue is whether this statute protects the broader state.
Yes, that is the issue before you.
And so now answer Judge Kavanaugh's question. It seems to me he's right that your answer hurt you, didn't help you.
I'm failing to get my point across. And let
go ahead, try
that.
Again.
The difference between the ABA standards aren't binding and aren't enforceable, therefore you can't interfere with them. The question is, what does that second clause mean? What it means is the government can't take steps that would prevent a state from disciplining a lawyer when they otherwise could. That's exactly what's going on here.
If the California standard is broader than the ABA standard, what difference does this all make?
If the California standard is broader than the ABA standard, then the court's choice of which standard is applicable matters. It matters because the California duty of confidentiality is broader.
So your case would be the same even if it didn't have the ABA part in the statute. Is that not correct?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. And the reason that I don't think so is that if the ABA standards are narrower and this court chose the ABA standards and then would have to take the further step of deciding what the ABA standards in fact said, because as we explained in our briefing, that's a chronological mishmash of many different things, then there would be a narrower and different standard applicable to the body of confidential information and work product that's at stake here. And
now,
there are
the sentence
both as to the duty of confidentiality and as to work
product. But the one you're relying on arises out of the second clause, the abrogation clause.
That's right.
The standard on which you're relying. Okay.
Well, then how do you want to go on then and explain what about the next sentence, which the government says a corporation shall ensure that activities under this subject are carried out in a manner consistent with attorneys, quote, professional responsibilities, which are defined in the previous sentence as those included in the ABA model code.
Your Honor, it's not obvious what Congress meant. I think Judge.
Well, all we have is the language.
That's correct, although we do have something more than that. We have both a statement of congressional purpose in the statute, and we have some legislative history, both of which are quoted in our opening brief.
Okay, but let's talk about this language before you get to the legislative history.
I'm happy to do so.
Go ahead. So the government's position is this sentence clearly protects only those ethical standards recognized in the ABA model code.
It's my suggestion to you that the word professional responsibilities in that last sentence could refer equally and easily to what's in either clause. But even if you...
Well, how you tell us how that would happen. How, since it's a defined term in the previous sentence, and it's defined in the first half of the sentence, how would that... It says ABA paren... Well, you know what it says.
I do, Your Honor, and I agree that there is a plural in one clause and a singular in the second clause and a plural in the second sentence. I would suggest to you that according an intentionality to Congress to distinguish between the singular and the plural is giving them more credit than they maybe do. But even if you think that that second sentence has only to do with the ABA standards, it's completely consistent with the distinction.
I wasn't relying on plural versus singular. The government's point is that it says, in the first sentence, referred to collectively as professional responsibilities.
The most you can say, the first clause says professional responsibilities, plural. The second clause says professional responsibility, singular. And says the professional...
Generally applicable to attorneys in such jurisdiction.
Generally That's, applicable to such
And then it goes back to the plural, which, as Judge Tatel says, is... I think it's defined. I mean, it's defined in a backwards way, but referred to collectively as professional responsibility.
The most you could say is that that second sentence reinforces the first clause of the first sentence by saying, look, you shouldn't interfere with these with attorneys' choices to comply with these non-binding standards, and you should make it easy for them. That is, you should not exercise your powers, your oversight powers, in a way that is inconsistent with attorneys complying with best
practices. But here's a rationale the other way, is that the reason, I use the word weird, why are the ABA standards and they're not each individual state standards? I think probably there's a desire for uniformity here and the difficulty of kind of going in and litigating state by state different standards for this kind of subpoena, and that kind of blends into the broader picture that's painted by some of our case law on the federal standard, federal privileges, what have you.
I'm into my...
No, you can keep going. Don't worry. We'll worry about that. We have a few more questions. You go ahead.
I'm very happy to answer.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me answer that. It is always the case that a federal regulator considers it more convenient to ignore variations in local state law.
Right.
That's not consistent with federalism, and a federalistic structure to the regulation of the legal profession is fundamentally what's been the case in the United States.
Not really. Well, just think about federal attorney-client privilege in federal criminal cases. That doesn't depend on what each individual state's attorney-client privilege is, right?
But these are...
That's right, isn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I should have answered your question.
Yeah.
It is correct that there is a uniform federal privilege that is applicable in federal cases. It's also the case that the duty of confidentiality varies dramatically state to state, and it's also the case, pardon me, that there are many examples of federal law deferring to state law.
I agree completely. I wish, for your sake, it would have been better, obviously, if they'd used the language they used in the second part of the clause and the first part of the clause.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that they are distinct clauses and they have distinct purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And in both the statement of congressional purpose and in the legislative history of the provision, what Congress says is, we want people to conform to the highest standards of the profession. And in fact, the American Bar Association had a substantial amount to do with the drafting and the adoption of the Legal Services Corporation Act in the 1970s.
When you refer here to the traditional regulation of the legal profession by the states, which certainly I totally agree with, but this is not, strictly speaking, regulation of the legal profession. This is regulation of the expenditure of government funds. This is a spending clause power, isn't it?
No, Your Honor.
Not?
Is it a regulation of the spending of government funds? Yes, it is, but it's a regulation.
Would you be in this court if it were not, in fact, federally funded?
You're certainly right about that. Okay. Well, there's federal legislation if the money had come from someplace else, but is it a federal issue? Certainly, but it's federal funding of lawyers.
Yeah.
And the lawyers are regulated by the states where they practice.
The lawyers are regulated by the states, but that doesn't mean the federal government can't regulate the expenditure of federal funds, does it?
I am not suggesting, Your Honor, that the government could not have said, you have to follow a set of ethical rules. It would have been astonishing and unprecedented for Congress to adopt a nationally uniform code of attorney ethics. Mm-hmm. And
that's why they just referred to the ABA.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the uniformity, but they didn't want to do what you just said.
If that were true, Your Honor, there would be no reason for the second half of the first sentence, which talks about the law applicable to the state, applicable to the attorneys in the jurisdiction where they practice. That's the law that is binding on them, and that is why the verb is abrogate the enforcement, because the subpoena in this case says, give me confidential information. The lawyer says, gee, if I give you confidential information, I am violating my duties under state law. I might be subject to discipline. The government says, no, you won't be subject to discipline because I'm making you. In other words, I am abrogating the authority of the state to discipline you by violating your duty of confidentiality. That's exactly what the subpoena does in this case. It's exactly what Congress was concerned about, because they were concerned that once you established, that once you tied federal money to legal services to the poor, which is a politically freighted problem, that regulators would come along and seek to interfere in the way that lawyers behaved, holding on to the purse strings as a means of drawing them into behavior otherwise would not be permitted to do under the law where they were, where they practiced. Now, is the ABA standard relevant? Of course it's relevant. It's a second standard that the government shouldn't interfere with, because as the Congressional Statement of Purpose says, the corporation should be encouraging everyone to practice according to the highest standards of the profession. That's the ABA rules. But that doesn't mean that that's the only rules they have to follow. In fact, you can't abrogate the enforcement of state disciplinary authority that the states have over the lawyers that they regulate. The reason this is important, and that it's
written, it actually says generally. It isn't written the way you just, that isn't the language of the.
It does say generally applicable.
It says generally applicable.
The rules of professional conduct are generally applicable to the lawyers who practice in the state of California. The rules of conduct of the state of Kansas are generally applicable to the lawyers who practice
in the state of Kansas. And once again, the next sentence, your best argument about why the next sentence doesn't resolve the issue.
Because the next sentence simply talks of, even if one assumes the distinction between the singular and the plural was deliberate, which quite frankly we don't think it was, but even if you assume that there was direct intentionality in that, all that second sentence says is something very similar to the first clause of the first sentence, which is, don't do anything that gets in the way of lawyers following the very best practices that are available to them. The middle clause says, don't prevent them from complying with the rules of professional conduct in the states where they practice.
All right.
So there are two obligations imposed on the government in this statute, and it is the second one, that is in the second clause of the first sentence, that is the particular obligation that is most important here. And it is most important here because that professional responsibility clause is, as this court decided in the New York Legal Services case, an express statutory limitation on the Inspector General's subpoena power.
Are you done with this subject?
Yes.
I want to ask you about my time. Yeah, I know you are, but we have a couple more questions.
I'm delighted to answer your question.
I want to ask you a question about the protective order.
I would be happy to answer.
Yeah. So what's your best argument that when the Inspector General submitted the protective order without the prior notice requirement, that was an abuse of discretion?
That it was an abuse of discretion?
Yeah. That's the standard, right, that we're looking at? Isn't that what Shriver and Owens say? That we look at the actions by the issuing agency, namely the Inspector General here?
I have a twofold answer to
that. Other than waiver? Other than waiver?
Other than waiver.
Okay, go ahead.
Other than waiver, the best argument is the facts in the record before you. The facts in the record before you include uncontradicted testimony that during the period when the parties were attempting to negotiate compliance with the subpoena, the government was asked, are you going to comply strictly with your obligations, and refused to confirm that it was. And I think if Your Honor reads the transcript of the argument before the district court, what you will see is that Judge Sullivan was deeply concerned about the way that the government was regarding its obligations and came right out of the box and said, I'm very concerned about making sure this confidential information is handled appropriately. He specifically asked about the failure to make a representation that the government intended to comply with the limitations on its use of the material. As a result, you have the standard that is articulated by this court in the Owens Corning case is, if there's a reason to doubt that the government will properly comply with its obligations, then the court has more discretion to fashion terms that are protective. And in this record,
we're only talking about the notice requirement, right? Yeah, and the IG thought that, number one, it went beyond the statute, right, 509I, and two, that it would interfere with law enforcement. I mean, so I think to win, you have to convince us that those reasons were an abuse of discretion.
It does not contradict the statute. The statute provides no notice requirement of any kind.
Right, but their argument is it's not required by the statute, so we're not going to do it. And again,
protective orders always impose obligations that are greater than the statutory concern. Here, the reason the district court imposed that concern was that when the government had been, and again, this is uncontradicted testimony in the record, when the government was asked, do you intend to strictly comply with the limitations on the use of this information, they said, we're not going to make that promise. In response to which the judge said, said on the record during the argument, I'm very concerned about this. I want to take extra steps to make sure the government complies with its obligations, not in a vacuum, but in the face of uncontradicted testimony that there was a significant concern about precisely that. And so he imposed a very modest, very limited, very specific notice requirement. Now, which is not contradictory to the statute. Yes, it's additional to the statute. Every protective order is additional to the statute. It doesn't contradict any obligation that the government has. And what's more, it's this subpoena in this investigation. It doesn't affect any other subpoena or any other investigation. And it is limited in these circumstances to a particular set of circumstances addressing the concern.
All right, thanks. You're way over your time, but we did it, and we'll give you some rebuttal time.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Right, I appreciate your interest in that.
Okay.
Thank
you. May it please the Court, Melissa Patterson for the United States and the Legal Services Corporation, Office of the Inspector General. I'd like to start with the construction of 2996E, which is what the issue on appeal here turns on. The respondent's reading here doesn't give any meaning to Congress's specific reference and specific definition of the professional responsibilities it was talking about as those established in the ABA canons and codes. You have to give some content to Congress's definition, and we think that our interpretation of what 2996E does that.
What content do you give to the second clause?
I think it's clear that Congress did not intend to set up LSC-funded attorneys as being only subject to federal regulators. They wanted to make clear that the federal government was somehow not preempting the field of attorney regulation and to preserve a state's role. And remember, in most cases perhaps, the professional responsibilities attorneys are required to follow are going to overlap in the federal and the state context. So if a state bar thinks that an LSC attorney is doing something improper, I think that clause, that abrogate clause, makes clear that the states and not just LSC can take action.
I was without conceding that compliance with this subpoena would be in contradiction of the standards of confidentiality imposed by the state as referenced in that clause. Would not then a plaintiff's appellant be entitled to relief here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The statute says that LSC can't abrogate a state's authority. So perhaps in that very hypothetical instance you've posited, LSC couldn't swoop into a state proceeding and say, no, don't get that person in trouble. They were just doing what we said.
That's what Congress meant by this clause is. You can't swoop into a state.
Well,
do you really suppose Congress was fearing that?
Well, the very next sentence, Your Honor, says, as Judge Tatel has quoted, LSC is supposed to ensure that attorneys abide by their professional responsibilities.
Right, but focus just, I want to hear your answer to Judge Sentell's question, because his point is that if the Inspector General forces the program to turn over a document that is not protected by the ABA but is protected by the state, then the state authorities cannot discipline that lawyer, right, for turning over that document.
I think states may choose not to. I think most states do have a kind of an other law exception. And this, I mean, I suppose you're getting at, there
wait,
is some...
Wait, no, stick with the... Stick
there
with
may
the,
well... The attorney...
The question we're asking you, which is, lawyer turns over a document that is not protected by the ABA, but is protected by state law, okay?
Yes.
Turn it over to the IG in response to a subpoena. And it's clear, isn't it, that the state enforcement authority, whatever it is, cannot discipline that lawyer for turning that document over to the Inspector General.
I think there might be a supremacy clause problem with that. I think but I think what the statute says is, LSC, you're not the one who can derail those enforcement proceedings. LSC, you are not the only ones who are regulating attorneys here. States still have a role, and states certainly do have a role here. We're not saying
and
they
when
don't.
When those two come up against each other, you don't seem to be coming to grips with the question we have, is where the obligation imposed by the state would include not releasing some document or information, and the obligation imposed by the federal subpoena calls for that release. What, if anything, is the role of that second clause in the first sentence of B3?
I'm not saying in every instance that state law never, ever has to give away to federal law. I'm trying to make sense of this statute that says...
Does it have to in light of this sentence in this statute? Can the Inspector General go out there and subpoena documents that are protected by state law without running afoul of the sentence that says that the corporation shall not abrogate?
I think so. I don't think in the sense, in the context of the statute, the word abrogate, that is an abrogation of states' authorities. States can do whatever they want. If they want to put their attorneys between a rock and a hard place and force them to go through a proceeding.
Their attorney between the rock and the hard place. They didn't do that.
Well,
attorneys were fine without any rocks or hard places.
Your Honor,
then the corporation put them in that.
I think that this line of argument that you can't do this, you can't go out and get things that are not protected by federal law or the ABA canons, but you cannot get things that are protected by state law, you can't get the things in that delta, that renders the don't interfere clause and its specific reference only to the ABA codes and canons nugatory. That clause has to be doing something. And what that clause says...
But I'm not getting what you think the abrogate clause is doing.
Well, Your Honor, when this...
You're right that we are here to see that each member of the statute performs a role, but I'm not quite understanding the role you think member two is providing there.
Well, Your Honor, when the Legal Services Corporation was set up in 1974, there's a lot of...
Go to 74. Tell me what role the statutory clause...
I'm saying that given all of the language in the statute... that gives the corporation a role in regulating attorneys and regulating attorney conduct, what that abrogating clause is making clear that Congress was not intending to cut the states out altogether.
It wasn't intending, to use preemption terminology, I read the abrogate clause as it's not field preemption of state regulation of LSC attorneys, but of course there's still
conflict preemption when there's a specific conflict between the federal duty. I mean, that's one theory I've thought of reading this, and so I thought I'd throw out the terminology there as to what it could mean.
I think that's right, Your Honor, and I think that view of what Congress was doing with the abrogating clause gives real content to the first clause.
So on the first clause, you said it would be nugatory, and I'm not sure that's necessarily right. And I'm not saying I disagree with you by posing this question, but consider this question, that they wanted the LSC to respect both state duties and ABA duties. And so to the extent the state duty was lower than the ABA duty, well, you've got to respect the higher ABA duty. We were talking about the delta and the flip situation where the state duty was higher than the ABA duty, but it could be the other way around. And maybe the first sentence is saying, don't just comply with the state duties, comply with the ABA duties. How about that?
I think if that's what Congress intended, they would have written different words in the statute. The words in the statute say, LSE, don't interfere. And the things you don't interfere by are those established in the canons and codes. Then, lest there's any doubt about the professional responsibilities
Don't interfere with the ABA. We know that.
Yes.
Okay. And then apart from that, arguably, as Judge Santel is saying, it is don't abrogate a state's authority. And arguably, if you tell a state, if you preempt a state, conflict preempt a state, even in a case of conflict, you are abrogating to some degree a state's authority. It's not full field preemption, but it's still some preemption, right?
I think if Congress had intended to stick state professional responsibility standards in with the ABA for the purposes of LSE interference, it would have used the same verb, interfering and abrogating. They clearly meant different things there.
They do, but why isn't counsel's explanation for the use of the two differing verbs perfectly plausible? That is to say, abrogate would have no role in the ABA clause because the ABA clause is without legal effect anyway. Abrogate could only apply to the states. It's a stronger word than interfere, isn't it?
Your Honor, I want to take issue with the premise that the ABA doesn't apply to anything by virtue of this statute.
It didn't apply to anything. It said the ABA is not mandatory.
It's not, but I believe it is mandatory by virtue of this statute.
When they were enacting this statute could not earlier have made it mandatory. They were looking at a world in which the ABA standards were not mandatory. Now, we don't have a time machine so they could go back and say, we're going to make them mandatory and then abrogate them. They were living in a world in which they were not mandatory. The verb abrogate would have had no role there, would it?
Your Honor, my point is, they seem
That's
to be saying...
That's not what I'm asking. I didn't ask you your point. I asked you, the verb abrogate could have had no role with reference to a standard that was not mandatory, could it?
I think that's right, if I'm understanding your question. They did use different verbs in these clauses, and they referred to different sets of professional responsibility standards.
One of which was a mandatory and one of which wasn't. So they used interfere with reference to the non-mandatory and abrogate with reference to the enforcement of the enforceable ones, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor, because by virtue of the statute that says don't interfere with these things are entrenched in federal law. And as
But they were not until this statute is enacted.
True, Your Honor.
They couldn't have said don't abrogate those things which are about to become mandatory, which are part of the same statute, and it couldn't possibly abrogate anyway. There's no role abrogate could have played with reference to the ABA standards, is there?
Your Honor, I think the idea that Congress meant to, I think our interpretation of what abrogate does there, it doesn't preempt the field, is more plausible, especially against the background of federalism principles. Usually, federal programs are not conditioned on a state-by-state basis. I think the briefing by amicus here has made clear there can be a lot of variance between, especially when we're talking about attorney-client and work product, each state's laws and a federal law.
Yeah, but there are many statutes, many federal statutes and federal programs that operate in accordance with varying state laws.
That's true, Your Honor.
All the time.
That's very true. And I think if they had wanted to do that, they would have been very clear, as indeed Congress was very clear in Section 505.
Right. That's a good argument for you. On abrogate, can I just ask it to focus my thinking, which is in the case where there is a conflict between the federal, between the ABA duty, sorry, and the state duty, I'm sorry, yeah, between what you're required to do by LSC and between the state duty. There's a conflict. Okay? So the state bar brings a discipline, the state court brings a disciplinary proceeding against you. And you defend by saying, I was forced to comply with federal law. So that's my defense. Now, if the state accedes to that, hasn't that abrogated the authority of the state to enforce its own professional responsibility standard?
I don't think within the meaning of...
At least in that case, in that one instance.
I don't think that's true, and within the meaning of what it means to abrogate here. You can imagine these hypothetical situations where there's a dust-up between the standards. I want to point out that is a very hypothetical.
You're in a really tough position because it's no fun to defend a state bar proceeding, even if you have a good federal defense, because it's time and money, and I'm sure Congress was concerned about that. I agree with you on a lot of your points here, but
again, Your Honor, if that's what Congress was trying to do, was trying to say this should be a state-by-state standard, this is an exceedingly odd way to do it, particularly because in other statutes about the release of information from LSC attorneys, specifically Section 505B, which we cite in our brief.
Why do you argue 505 in your brief? What is that?
Let me find the page.
I'll let you get back to your point in a moment, but I want to look at what the...
It is at page, I believe, 35, 36, Your Honor. Public Law 105, 119. It says, when the member of a public wants certain information, you have to give it to them, unless there's some reason in federal or state law that says you should not have to give them this information. So when Congress has wanted to restrict information flow out of LSC-funded attorneys by state law, by the varying standards of a state, it has been very explicit.
Although you could read this as saying unless it's protected by ABA or state law, which is a little weird to have the ABA in, but that's what they did.
But ABA has been made part of federal law by virtue of the interfere clause. So it
In other words, I'm getting at this point I asked before, and it is a mess, I understand that, but why couldn't you reasonably make sense of all this by saying you have to LSC has to respect both ABA standards and the individual state standards? It'd be a very simple rule, right?
I think that would be a simple rule in conflict with that reference and a specific definition to one uniform standard. Let's think about what the ABA canons and codes are. They're a general distillation. It's one thing that you look at. Now, we're willing to have a fight about what that one thing means.
The ABA or the LSC attorneys, don't want to get too real politique here, but when this was drafted, I think there was a lot of concern about the attorneys, and some state codes might not have given the protection that some attorneys who would be doing LSC work might want. So the ABA, which is involved in helping draft this, by the way, puts in this reference as well to give a higher protection than just the state codes in those jurisdictions. I mean, that's a
I don't think that's plausible given what the ABA canons and codes are. They're looking at the general principles, the kind of universal stuff.
I know, but some ABA standards are higher than certain aspects of certain state ethics rules, correct?
I imagine so, and some may be lower.
Right, exactly.
But I think the point in referring to just one thing, as Congress very specifically did.
We all agree, I think, you have to meet the ABA.
Yeah.
Or the LSC has to respect the ABA. The question is whether you have to respect both the ABA and the states in a case where the state has a higher standard or just the ABA.
And I think Congress is juxtaposing in the first clause, don't interfere with the ABA,
right,
with the varying standards in the second clause, was designed to say, LSC, you can't interfere with this one uniform thing. But it would be very odd if by that language, especially given that Congress knows how to make state standards applicable to federal programs when it wants to, in this precise context, that is a very, very odd way to get at entrenching a state standard.
I started agree with the proposition that this is an odd statute. I'm
yes,
not sure it gets you anywhere to point it out one more time.
I'd also like to return to the proposition that everything in the statute has to mean something, and we think our reading...
I've still got a real problem figuring out what you think the second clause means. You're absolutely right. Everything in the statute has to mean something. But I'm not sure that makes you win. That may make you lose, because I'm not sure what you think the second clause means.
Your Honor, I think especially when you compare it with other statutes where Congress has acted in other areas to entrench state standards, that our reading most plausibly gives effect to what Congress, its language, and what it intended to do here. If I could turn briefly, I know I'm out of time, but if I could just turn briefly to the cross appeal issues.
Yes, why don't you say something about that? That's a good idea. Particularly respond to what
There are a number of things that respondents describe as facts here. The district court did not make any of these factual findings. There are a number of allegations in the record below. We did not respond to many of them because we did not consider them relevant. The district court did not consider it relevant, and that's why he did not make findings about them. So I don't think that you can point to allegations that the district court has never signed on to as a reason for the district court's addition of a protective condition here. The district court never explained why he added this particular provision. He just said he thought it was advisable. And I think that Schreiber and Owens Corning and Texaco, all these cases make clear that when a district court is adding conditions, it needs to explain why the conditions offered by the agency in the first instance were insufficient. I don't think there's that kind of explanation here. LSC repeatedly made clear its objection to this type of condition and repeatedly made clear to exactly which conditions it was willing to abide by. And furthermore, we just don't think that condition is reasonable. The whole purpose of the 509I is to investigate, and that would stymie an investigation.
Indulge me a moment with a statement of exactly what you think the condition is that's unreasonable.
Why this condition is unreasonable?
No, tell me which condition is unreasonable.
The only condition that we're challenging, which is that before we make a disclosure permitted by 509I to a law enforcement or bar official, we have to give CRLA 5 days notice that we are going to, for a suspected violation, that we're going to give CRLA 5 days notice before
What's
we.
What's unreasonable about that?
I think the whole purpose.
5 days?
I think, as we said in our district court papers, that type of disclosure could derail an investigation. The whole reason behind the 509I exception is that you may suspect there has been wrongdoing. It's rather extraordinary to say, before you report that wrongdoing to the relevant officials, you have to give the target of that investigation notice that you're going to start this investigation. Now, again, we don't think
about destruction of evidence, right?
That could well be. We don't think we have to show that condition is unreasonable. This court's been very clear. The question is not whether the district court's added condition is reasonable. It's whether the initial conditions were reasonable. But even if for some reason this court were to engage in evaluating the reasonableness of that condition, we don't think it's reasonable.
If we don't engage in that ascertainment, what is our standard of review?
The standard of review is to look whether or not the agency in its first instance abused its discretion.
Now, we're looking now at the court's protective order. What is our standard of review of the court's protective order?
It is abuse of discretion. Whether the district court abused its discretion, but this court has made clear that a district court abused its discretion unless it finds that the agency abused its discretion. So it's an abuse of discretion squared standard here. There are no further questions. We ask you to affirm the enforcement of the subpoena.
Thank you. Got it. Yeah.
But to reverse the condition.
Thank you. Mr. Burke, you could take 3 minutes.
I want to spend my entire 3 minutes emphasizing how implausible the government's interpretation of EB3 is. It is implausible from the standpoint of looking at the Statement of Congressional Purpose and the circumstances that were prevailing at the time the statute was adopted. The government describes this as some kind of limited anti-swooping provision or something that prevents the government from derailing a disciplinary proceeding if state
There's more than that. Sorry to interrupt, but there's the making clear that we're not preempting the field of state regulation of attorneys who are doing the LSC work.
To the extent that you're not preempting the field, it seems to me the express meaning of the second clause is you've got to respect state law, too. Mm-hmm. Let me emphasize for a second how doubly peculiar it would be if the government were correct and there were one national standard that was defined by ABA standards, whatever they amount to, and no regard given to state law. On the one hand, you would have a statute that said the government was obligated not to interfere with attorneys' compliance with obligations they don't have, right? Because they're not obligated to follow those laws. On the other hand...
Yeah, but that helps the attorneys, in other words.
It helps the attorneys, but it doesn't make any
sense. That's a limitation on government power there.
And it's intended to be a limitation on government power.
It's not supposed to be an enforcement mechanism against the attorneys.
It's...
So I don't think your premise there works.
I understand Your Honor's point. It is, nevertheless... Well, I would submit to you, odd to suggest that they shouldn't interfere with duties they don't have at the same time as it puts them in a position where the government can force compliance with standards that the lawyers are obligated to follow.
They force them to violate state law, which is, you know, that's
right.
I think that's a good point.
And the notion that there's no need that there's an important need to worry about a uniform national standard. The fact of the matter is federal lawyers constantly practice under the ethical rules of the states in which they practice.
Yeah, but we have a statute here.
There's been a deal of litigation about that, too, counsel.
We also have a specific statute here we're trying to interpret that
yes.
isn't in the Federal Trade Commission Act or the NLRB, NLRA. Look, tell me what's wrong with this very simple view of this statute. So when Congress passed the LS, the Corporation Act, I mean, this was a very controversial thing. They're funding legal services. And so the first part of the first sentence says, you're gonna protect, everybody was worried about privileges, so we're gonna protect ABA privileges, that's national. No interference with those. Second part of the sentence, reassure state bars that this massive new program of funding lawyers practicing in the state will not interfere with state authority with respect to standards generally applicable. And then the second sentence makes quite clear that what it is that the LSC cannot interfere with are the ABA standards. I mean, that seems to me to be what's wrong with looking at it that way?
Well, I suppose what's wrong with it is that you've assumed, Judge Tatel, that your interpretation of the second clause doesn't involve a massive intrusion in and displacement of state law, as demonstrated by this very case, in which it is absolutely undisputed. Several things are undisputed. It is undisputed that this subpoena calls for information that is confidential under California law.
Yeah.
It is undisputed that the subpoena calls for information that is subject to work product protections under California but not federal law. It is undisputed in this situation that if attorneys had turned over that material in the absence of this compulsion, they would be violating their ethical obligations under state law.
Well, we're trying to reconcile all provisions of this statute.
Sure.
And I'm wondering why what I suggested. Sure, it does limit state authority, but only to the extent that it's superseded by federal authority with respect to these federally funded lawyers.
Well, I think then, Judge Tatel, you've answered your own question because if you say, sure, it limits state authority, then that's not consistent with the statute, which says the corporation shall not
have... It says generally applicable.
Generally applicable, that's the description that is given to rules of professional conduct. They are generally applicable to the attorneys who practice here.
Well, then what is, under your theory, what does the second sentence do?
What the second sentence does is to reiterate the importance of the highest standards of practice repeatedly. It's seen in the Congressional Statement of Purpose of this statute that everything the corporation does should be structured and done in a way that is consistent with best practices, not merely with the minimum standards of conduct that a state might impose.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Case submitted.